Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to Savage Starlight, the officially unofficial podcast for The Last of Us on HBO. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking Season 1, Episode 6, Akin. Aaron, what'd you think of this episode after multiple watches?
I liked the episode quite a bit when I first watched it. I've watched it a couple times since then. I feel like I like it a little bit more. I think also there's a lot of, you know, kind of deep cuts that they put in here in terms of character notes, in terms of, world building that I got a lot out of after I watched listened to the official podcast and watched the episode again. I really like it. I think we talked last week about the necessity sometimes at the game when it throws a real banger action sequence at you for it usually paces it out. So where the next time you rejoin Joel and Ellie in the action, they're just kind of walking through a fairly tranquil, peaceful, you know, to give you time to process it as well as the characters. And I feel like this episode was that little interim sequence where it's bridges to what's going to be, you know, two pretty intense set pieces, it seems, with lots of drama, lots of personal stakes with this episode, which is entirely based on the relationship of Joel and Ellie and whether they're going to finally, well, I guess whether Joel is finally going to be able to trust himself, trust Ellie, learn to fully love and commit again.
Or whether he's dead. Like, you know, whether he's failed her for the final time, you know, it's rough.
And I still really like the post-apocalyptic living. You know, I like the commune lifestyle. I thought that was like, you know, getting to see Jackson was a real treat. What about you, Jim?
Yeah, no, I'm with you. I like it better the second time around. I got more of the nuance and the things that they were trying to do emotionally with Joel here. And it worked really well for me. It's okay that this is a slower episode, that there's not a single infected in the entire episode. I think that's fine. I've never had a huge problem with that in this show. I really enjoyed it. And it is ending on a big cliffhanger. I typically don't like cliffhangers like these because it's not a what next kind of cliffhanger. It's a what happened kind of cliffhanger. You know, is Joel dead? Isn't he dead? How is that going to affect Ellie? I'd like to know the outcome of that, so I know how that affects Ellie, or doesn't if he lives. You know, I don't know. Those cliffhangers usually don't do it for me, but I feel like I'm willing to forgive that in this show because it's been so good up to now.
There's a debate among the online critic community, it seems, about whether this actually qualifies as a true cliffhanger because, you know, a cliffhanger is kind of like, will someone or won't someone die or get out of a situation? Whereas this was more of like, you know, how is Ellie going to react to the situation? Which is the kind of, you know, those are the cliffhangers we like, you know, the ones that are just like, oh, God, something just happened. Now what is going to be the response? I think it's a cliffhanger. It's intended to be a cliffhanger.
Yeah, pretty obviously.
Joel could potentially be mortally wounded. Any wound to the torso in this society could be a fatal wound. They are 5 days ride from any assistance. You know, if this happened right outside the gates of Jackson, you just wheel around, they probably have penicillin or, you know, this certainly it'd be easier to get treated, but like they are, no, Ellie, she is utterly alone. And, you know,
the whole episode territory. Yeah.
And the whole episode has told us that she can't do this without him. She doesn't think she can do, you know, Ellie thinks she can do anything, but she doesn't think she can get herself safely to the Firefly medical research compound without Joel. And she's probably right on that. So is it a cliffhanger? I don't know.
Yeah, it's certainly a cliffhanger. I think there's a big opportunity for growth here for Ellie, regardless of what happens with Joel. Right. Because clearly, if he lives, he's in no state to take care of himself. If he dies, he's abandoned her and she's completely alone. So, like, she's going to have to level up in some kind of way, right, to get through this. And, yeah, I'm super excited to see how they play that next episode.
Yeah, and that, you know, I will say that when I was playing the game the first time through, I felt like it wasn't a foregone conclusion that Ellie and Joel would make it through the end of the story.
Sure.
Yeah. And when you're watching this TV show, I think that there's a lot of death. This is a really realistic universe, and I think that's got to be on your mind. That literally, no one is safe in the Last of Us universe. And you know, mm-hmm. we're getting to towards the end of the series, and a potential arc. You know, obviously an arc is Joel and Ellie can learn to love each other as surrogate father and daughter, and find a way in the world. But part of it is could be a coming of age Ellie story where she has to grow and stretch, you know, like an anti Joel, like, you know, Joel is forged in the fires of Sarah dying. It could possibly be that Ellie's going to be forged in the fires of, her surrogate father dying before the end of this thing. So it's like, mm-hmm. like some people are saying a schmuck bait. And the schmuck bait is like in the middle of Star Trek season 3 when Picard crashes on a planet with Wesley and he's dying of thirst. And oh my God, is Captain mm-hmm. Picard going to die on his random ass episode where he's delivering Wesley to Starfleet? That's schmuck bait.
Yeah.
Joel could fucking die.
Uh-huh.
You know? So it's like, I feel like it's kind of damning it, but saying it's a cliffhanger. But yeah, I can, it sounds like you've come down on the same side with me, just with way less words.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm with you there. And yeah, so much of this episode is so good, and I'm excited to get to talking about it. So why don't we get into the recap?
Let's do it.
All right, we start off seeing Henry kill himself again. That was not fun. But 3 months later, now it's winter, and Joel and Ellie hold a couple of people at gunpoint and demand to know where they are and if they've seen Tommy or the Fireflies. They haven't, but they show them their location on the map, warning them not to go west to the River of Death. But that's exactly where they've got to go. When they leave, Joel has the beginnings of a panic attack, but it subsides.
Yeah, I put a big smile on my face, this scene, and I loved it even more the subsequent trips through to see Graham Greene and Elaine Miles, this like old elderly couple, completely content with this lifestyle, have been living this lifestyle since before Joel was born, which I don't know about that, but uh-huh. but yeah, for a long time, right? And that's just him saying like, look, whippersnapper. And just how I don't know whether they have the measure of Joel and Ellie. I guess it's hard to put a gun on someone when you've already know that they've sat and had a bowl of soup with your wife, maybe. And mm-hmm. to take him seriously as like a real bandito, but I just love the way they played this. Is like an old couple kind of amused that something is happening in their life more than, oh my God, we're going to die here.
Yeah, no, it's great. Their interactions are a lot of fun. I love this old. I love both of their demeanors here, but this old man just being like, his wife's like, they didn't hurt me. It's like, I have eyes. And then Joel asks, like, have you seen my brother? And he's like, I haven't. Joel's like, I haven't told you what he looks like. Does he look like you? Yeah, well, right. I haven't seen him.
Yeah, I haven't seen anyone that doesn't look like this woman for 30 years, kid. And this is like, there's so much on when I was seeing it for, because like, there's a lot of crosstalk. And I there's a lot of like really subtle ironies. Like when she says that they haven't hurt me, by the way, it's like, I've got eyes. She's like trying, if he was a little bit more observant, he wouldn't have been surprised that Joel's holding her at gunpoint, because she was like telling him with her eyes that there's something over there. So that was really funny. And then the whole, did you make him soup? But she's like, yeah, it's cold out. It's just really funny. And then mm-hmm. Bella comes down all three parts piss to two parts vinegar. And, you know, she's like using her mouth, and Graham Greene's like, holy, like,
who's this little psycho? Yeah.
Yeah. It's so funny. And just like, you know, like, you better point this out on a map, and you better. And he's like, looks at his wife like, did you tell him the truth? Are you telling me the truth? It's just, this show doesn't have very many laughs. This is some vaudeville shit here.
Yeah, usually it's just Ellie, and it's nice to see some other personality telling some jokes here. Yeah, the other thing I noticed, like, right off the bat here is animals are apparently not affected by the cordyceps. We've got rabbits that you can hunt that are still out there, uninfected, seemingly. Do you think that's because they typically run higher temperatures than humans do?
It's a lot of things. Like, it's very rare to see a parasite that is adapted to parasite more than, like, you know, like they usually specialize. Like, it's not just like it's not just like a fish. It's like a certain species of fish that's in this location, that's this temperature range. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, it's an arms race, like evading the lethal environment that is the inside of a vertebrate organism with their active immune system and whatnot is tough. So it's usually, if you can do it once, it's not like something you just do again and again and again, or you evolve to the point where you're dependent on this new prey species. So no, mm-hmm. I think it makes a lot of sense that this cordyceps only affects humans and would have a hard time infecting even primates. And I think that the monkeys are there for that, right?
Uh-huh.
You know, like, there's no cordyceps monkeys. Maybe we need to see like a gorilla to make sure that there are a chimpanzee or bonobo. Bonobo? I don't know how those monkeys are pronounced. Those apes are pronounced. Mm-hmm. But, like, yeah, like, this suggests that, like, you can, you know, it's pretty specific to the species.
How about this panic attack that Joel's having? I guess my question is, why now? He says, you know, it's the cold air. It's definitely not the cold air. What do you think is going on with Joel here? Why is his panic attack stuff manifesting now?
He's getting close. He's getting close to someone, like, you know, there's this. So I've had panic attacks. And the first time I had one is my late 20s. I was working at this very stressful job. And I was working like 75-hour weeks, and it was coming up on Christmas break. And my company, this consulting company, always shut down for a week between Christmas. And I was just like, if I could just fucking hold on to this break, I'll be fine. And I was fine. I had a great vacation. The night before I went back to work, I had my first ever panic attack. And a lot of times this stuff happens, like, where you get a chance to kind of chill for a minute, and your body and brain, who has been this white knuckling existence, finally says, fuck, thank God I can let go. And then that's when the ramifications of the psychological damage you've been taking appear. So I think Joel has no choice but to keep going when it's him and Ellie, but he's getting close to Tommy, and his body and mind are probably even subconsciously aware that, like, this is a chance that we can let Ellie go. I can give her to someone that I trust, and who's not just I trust, he's better than me. He's just me, only younger and stronger. And, like, I think that's why the panic attacks are happening. He's getting to that point where his body and mind knows he can relax, and it doesn't have to sustain him anymore, I think.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I'd also say he's failed her many times at this point, and those have kind of stacked up on him, right? You gotta imagine, the first time he failed her, he's like, that's a fluke, you know, we'll be fine. And then the second time it happens, okay, well, that kid almost killed me. The third time it's going to happen here might be a little more severe.
I think that's a possible answer. I think the 3 months later of it all suggests that they've had a fairly uneventful last 3 months. So, like, it's got to be stacking with something else, because the game does that too. You know, it's not like Ellie and Joel's cross-country trip is beset by perils all the time. It's
right.
You in the game, you only join Ellie and Joel before some shit's about to happen, right? But you'll have months go by where it's relatively peaceful, and they just have to do basic survival stuff. Stay warm, stay dry, stay fed. It's definitely the failures that he's experienced thus far are feeding into the stress and, you know, like I said, his body mind white knuckling the situation. But
for sure, yeah,
it does feel like the subconsciously the pressure just might be letting off a little bit as he's getting. But he also has no idea if he's found Tommy or not, so, like, maybe not.
Yeah, I mean, he's got to know he's close though, looking at those maps.
Right. And even if subconsciously he doesn't know you can relax pretty soon, there's also, like, it's not like your mind and body can white knuckle existence forever. Like,
sure.
you know, like, Eventually you'll snap, right? But I just know that in my case, it seems like it's well attested to that if you have, it's paradoxically, you have a period of kind of peace and quiet that can bring on a panic attack that you've been suppressing for a long, long time. Now's the time to endure and survive. We'll be back with more Savage Starlight.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of Apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off badass season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if very special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
Just so we're clear about back there, it was either us or the ad. Welcome back to more Savage Starlight. All right, let's go to Ellie and Joel setting out to cross the River of Death. They camp for the night. Ellie tries some booze again, I guess, which she hates. Ellie asks what's next for them after the Fireflies make a cure for her blood from her blood. Joel wants to live alone on a sheep ranch. Ellie wants to go to the moon. Ellie wonders if the Fireflies will really be able to create a cure. And Joel believes they will because Marlene does. And then Joel decides, I'm going to take both watches tonight. That's the other thing that I bet has really contributed to this is Joel is not getting any sleep. I mean, if you look at like all the scenes where they've been driving, all the implied watches that he's probably been taking because he refuses for some reason to teach Ellie to do more and to trust Ellie to do more. And obviously I know what that reason is. He's scared for her, but like, boy, he is taking a lot on himself and depriving himself of sleep and food. We've seen it time and time again. Like, he is physically very run down as well. And that does not help.
Yeah, and he looks like it. I feel like Pedro is starting to look a little frayed at the ends here. You know, with his shaggy haircut.
His boots are useless.
Boots, a little bit more lines in his face. Yeah. I mean, I love the sequence. I love the Fire Knight chat. I thought that the way they shot this is gorgeous. Them just talking about their hopes and dreams. This is something that Neil pointed out in the official podcast, that as he grew closer to the characters of Joel and Ellie, and also as he worked with Ashley Johnson and Nolan North?
Troy Baker?
Not him, the other guy.
Yeah, right, the two big ones.
He got closer to Troy Baker. He found that he kept on giving Ellie and Joel character beats that were personal to the actors portraying them. Like Ashley Johnson is like an unabashed space enthusiast, so he started writing little things about, like, Ellie has become fascinated in the post-apocalypse about space. Troy is, I guess, a accomplished guitarist and singer, and so he's like, oh, Joel, that's when in the quiet moments, like, that's kind of something that he's always kind of fantasized about, and I'll give him that. I thought that was really cool that, you know, each of the people portraying Joel has kind of like give, or, you know, the characters in The Last of Us kind of, you know, not just embody them, but there's like a two-way flow to that, which I thought was really cool. And the line, you know, but you know who my favorite is? Sally Ride. Sally fucking Ride.
It is a great astronaut name. She's right.
It is a great astronaut name. And I just, yeah, the fact that, of course, Ellie would gravitate to the first female astronaut.
Mm-hmm.
I just thought that was great. And the fact that Joel, who probably only knows one female astronaut's name, just threw it out there. Sally Ride. It's great.
Yeah. Oh, especially in 2003. Yeah. You're going to know a lot fewer female astronaut names. I like it, and I like the reason they give for Ellie, you know, wanting to go to the moon or space or whatever. It's because she's been trapped for so long, right? This is like the idea of escape, exploration, that kind of thing. She's only been able to look up for anything interesting.
Yeah, and I just agree. Yeah, like, grow up to QZ, they're in Boston. Mm-hmm. You got the back to the ocean in front of you is a wall. Where else do you look up as a kid? But where else do you look up as a kid than up? Where else do you look up as a kid than up? Where else do you look as a kid than up? Is I think what I was trying to say there.
Yeah.
All right, and Joel, do you think that Joel's sheep dream is like sincere? Was like he just?
Well, this is his way of saying shut up and go to sleep, kid.
Right.
But also, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because like he's, I don't, like, know. I just think he's like a giant sheep ranch too.
True. I got the opinion that, like, when he's like to a ranch, he had a clear idea. He's like, yeah, I want to be there, but then he's kind of like trying to find like what this ranch would be doing. It's like, what kind of mm-hmm. physical labor could a single guy handle? Cat, no, there's no fucking way, you know, like sheep, yeah, there you go, sheep. Chicken, that's chicken's not hard enough. Rabbits, nah, sheep, that's where it's at.
Yeah, well, he should go back to that shack and pick up those two old goats. He can start his ranch with them. All right, let's move on to the next part of this scene and a couple others. Joel falls asleep again. So apparently Ellie took the second watch. Joel and Ellie cross the bridge over the River of Death with a lot of tense music, but completely without incident. Ellie tries to learn how to whistle. She wants to be taught how to hunt. And finally, they reach a hydro power station. I guess we'll stop there for a second.
I didn't get this in the first time I watched it because, I don't know. I just watched it the first time and I didn't hear it. But like they do show that Joel is kind of having these nightmares. They're suggesting that he's having this uneasy sleep. Mm-hmm. Not getting much of it, but the little sleep he has is fitful. I thought that was great. That, like, just watching Pedro do simple exercises, like a man that wakes up, doesn't realize where he's at, then has a sudden panic attack of where he is and what time it is and what could be happening. And like, he's just really good at doing all that stuff. And then he snaps awake, and then Ellie's standing there like a boss with the rifle, you know, okay, I'm keeping watch just like you taught me to.
Yeah, she's very capable. You know, but Joel can't, he probably sees that. He just can't let himself rely on it, right? Because he's supposed to be protecting her.
Yeah, and that's the other thing is, like, Ellie's a little bit hurt that he doesn't acknowledge her competency.
Mm-hmm.
But And even like Joel's kind of like, you know, really comes across really grumpy. I interpret that as like Joel is disappointed and mad at himself.
Yep.
And he's not skilled enough to keep that emotion from showing through to the child he's with. So it's like, you know, and she's, of course, interpreting that as like he's angry with her that she disobeyed again. But I think it's really more upset with himself for being, you know, weak, for needing to sleep.
Yeah. And of course, she can't see it for what it is. Right. I mean, he's given her no insight into himself, into what he's thinking or feeling. So how could she think, oh, this man thinks he's failing me at every turn, so much so that I love how they describe it later in the episode. He's failing in his sleep. He doesn't remember specifics, but he just wakes up with a sense of loss.
Yeah.
And some of that's probably tied up in Sarah, but a lot of that now is tied up in this mission with Ellie.
Yeah.
Because he already wasn't sleeping great before the Ellie stuff. I think he was haunted by the Sarah stuff, and now this is just stacking up on top of that, right?
Yeah, for sure, for sure.
And this is exactly how Henry got the drop on them. If Henry hadn't been a friend, if Henry had been an enemy, they could both be dead right now. But because Joel keeps failing, his whole goal here was to stay awake through the night, and he didn't. So that's rough.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's got to be hard to put this many impossible standards on yourself. But also, what else are you going to do? Can you really trust a 14-year-old of any stripe to kind of keep watch? But then again, you know, he can't trust himself either.
right.
And that's, I mean, it's also like you mentioned about how closed off he was. That's what it's wild that 3 to 4 months into their journey together, think about all the downtime, all the travel time, all the long, like, you know, all the time they could have been talking, and the way Ellie talks, probably a lot of that. And Joel has never even told her about his daughter.
Yeah.
Like, she truly doesn't even know square one to this guy. I think that's, you know, it's like, to us, we've only been watching the show 6 hours, but, you know, there's been a lot of time passed. I thought that was a great way for the show this show did feel like the pivot, you know, like where Joel does finally come around and like all of his secrets are laid bare and he finally can kind of like be open and honest with Ellie and vice versa. Like, it's a huge change between how they react at the end of the episode versus how they react in the beginning.
Yeah, I wonder how the conversations are going to change in the future as a result of this, as a result of the knowledge that she now has about Sarah, the fear that he's made known to her, I think, through his actions this episode. I'm curious to see what next episode, if Joel survives, would look like for them. I got one big question for you here that I didn't understand. So they come to the River of Death and there's a bridge. They take a shot. They fire off a round from Joel's rifle to do something. And I don't understand it, because in my mind, the last thing you want to do is announce your presence at this junction.
Yeah.
What are they trying to accomplish with that?
I think it's, they had not fully committed to crossing the River of Death. They're still at the edge of a tree line on the other side of the river valley. And Joel's thought process is, if I take a shot and there's like, you know, in a bunch of infected, I can get, or if I take a shot and there's like, you know, I draw fire, I'm far enough that they're probably not going to be able to hit me. Of course, he doesn't know that Tommy's out there with his fucking sub MOA rifle. You know what I'm saying? Like, I think that's what it is. It did strike me as dumb. It did strike me as a little dumb.
Yeah, I would, if I felt like I had to cross that bridge, I would just try and sneak through unannounced, not announce my presence and then cross it. If anything, I would announce my presence, leave the location and go cross somewhere else if I knew there was another crossing. But like,
is there also the implication that Joel doesn't quite know that they've crossed a River of Death? Because like, I think that there was like in the scene that before they ride up on him, like Ellie's like, do you think that was a River of Death? And he like kind of like concernedly starts looking at the map right before they ride up on him. So maybe it's like he doesn't know, like he's kind of got, because look, I don't think Joel is a great orienteer. Like Graham Greene said, how do you get lost if you have a map, you know? So I don't think he's great, and he's clearly crossed a river of death without meaning to. I think he meant to go around it. So maybe that's why the gunfire too, is he didn't know that there was like extreme danger.
Okay. Yeah, there have been a few things in the show that have puzzled me like this, and that was one of them. So just curious. Do you know how hydropower stations work? Because I don't.
I mean,
I know there's some kind of like magnetic induction that
there you go
from water wheels and shit.
Magnets,
yeah.
If you move them over copper wire, induces electron flow, and if you put a paddle wheel with magnets around the axle and you turn and it's going to, the wire's going to turn it inside the magnets and boom, magic electricity.
And you got the copper wire wound. I couldn't tell you the science of it, but I
couldn't tell you the science of keeping one of these things running too in the apocalypse.
No.
You know? What, like this thing, the turbine eventually, although they do last forever, like the Hoover Dam's been generating energy and power for like 70 years now.
True.
But like, yeah, you got to wonder like what happens at the end of this thing's lifespan if they have this huge community built on and, you know, like what does the fall of Jackson look like?
Yeah, I hope people are reading up, doing experiments on alternative energy sources, because
it's got it. Like, this seems like a type of community that would like, hey, we have to use these boom times while we still have power to prepare for the times after when we're not going to if we want to. But
I don't know. It seems they're more concerned about bacon and whiskey, but we'll
I would
see.
Honestly love to see a 3 or 4 season episode, a show just set in like this Jackson, Wyoming, because I've always felt like I've gotten screwed out of like post-apocalyptic zombie living. Like, I really was hoping that the Walking Dead would get there, and they did kind of, but man, I think this is a really cool hook. Like, since you could do any Western, any frontier town, except for now there's zombies. Still got raiders, you still got hostile people, you still got innocent villagers and townsfolk needing help, and you also got zombies. Like, it's bonanza. Yeah. Only zombies. Why can't that work?
Why can't we do a television series? I would love to see this. Here's an idea. Discover, call me or something. Let's do, so many people love these survival crafting video games. I want to see a survival crafting TV show where, like, they set up an abandoned town full of things that people can scavenge. They give, like, 20 people a plot of land with maybe a bit of shelter on it or something to start. And they say, create a functioning society out of this. We're going to give you 4 seasons, 5 seasons, whatever. Five years to do it. What could they come up with in 5 years? How far along that progress tree, that tech tree, could they get given that much time?
Because you got a little bit of Big Brother, you know, all these desperate people
working together.
You've got a little bit of, because like there is a show on Nat Geo called Alone, where I think they take 12 survivalists each season and they drop them off on some remote desert island or...
Oh, there's a ton, like
Olympic
Naked
Peninsula,
and Afraid, right? There's like tons of those shows.
Yeah, yeah.
But they're not focused around like rebuilding a society. They're focused around like hunt a rabbit and skin it and use it as boots or something. I'm like, can we do with like scavenged parts from a dead society?
Survive for a week, knowledge? Not rekindle society. That would be kind of cool.
I would watch it. All right.
Get on it. Get on it, Disco Max. Come on.
Yep. They come across another river, and Ellie wonders, oh, maybe that's the River of Death. And just then, a bunch of people on horseback surround them. They have what I'm going to call a truffle-sniffing dog, because I think it's funny. Try to sniff out any infection in them. Ellie somehow passes the test. Don't ask me how. I guess the dog just can't smell that well. Joel mentions that he's looking for his brother, which prompts one of the people to ask his name. Why can't the dog smell her infection? Just not as sensitive as the sensors that the QZ has?
I don't know, man. Because there's two possibilities. One, that the dog is maybe more sensitive and that it can detect an active infection versus a latent infection.
Okay.
The other thing that the other theory that I think I came up with is an instant take that I kind of like is that Ellie's not act like if Ellie would be scanned by Fedra scanner right now, she'd show up as non-affected because it's been many months since the last bite. There are no active cordyceps.
Possibly. We don't really
cells
know,
in
right?
her body. Yeah, I mean, I'm just speculating like what could cause it to fail. Is that it's possible that she just no longer is even passively infected.
Sure.
You know, like her body is completely just shut that shit down and just scar tissue now. So I don't know. This is a detail that was not in the video games. So
yeah, no, I don't know if they need to spell that out anymore. I think it's fine to just leave some of that ambiguous. But
or
I
the
was
other thing is, the other thing is like I guess there's this idea that there's you know like with COVID tests, like a lot of times COVID tests for antibodies, which is the you know like the evidence that you used to have an infection, not that you're currently infected, right? And the dogs might essentially, you know, or the scanners might detect those antibodies that said that you have been infected or you were infected versus the dog only cares about whether you are infected. I don't know.
Yes.
But I'm not sure. I'm not sure if it'll play into the season later on, these breadcrumbs. We'll have to see.
Yeah, we'll see. So they all ride back to the gated town of Jackson, where Joel is reunited with Tommy. Here we go. I'm excited to see this. I'm excited to see Tommy still working construction. He's doing what he does best.
It's a contractor.
He's a goddamn contractor. this is such a good scene. It's all like really subtle work here with just looks and stuff, but there's so much going on in this scene beyond just the joy of being reunited with the two brothers being reunited. There's a lot of tension in that moment, especially if you look over at Ellie and Tommy and Joel reunited is a little bit threatening to her. It's a little bit scary for her, and you can see it on her face at the very end of this scene.
And Ellie picks up on it, which is why she doesn't. I think that's one of the barriers that kind of she doesn't really take a shine to Maria the same way she took a little bit of a shine to Tess, is that she realizes that she doesn't like Joel. She sees Joel as a threat.
Oh, and I'm talking about even for Ellie, like this is a bit of a threat, right? Because Joel has been her sole protector the whole time.
Okay, I thought we were talking about Maria here. Okay. Oh wow, I didn't see that she. I mean, that's a possibility that that she's clocking here.
Yeah, like this could be the end of the road for her and Joel. Or maybe she sees the other possibility here is she sees that Joel is not as emotionally shut off completely from everyone. Mm-hmm. Maybe she thinks it's just her. Maybe seeing this affection, obviously, between brothers is like maybe there's a little bit of envy there.
Oh, and also just seeing another side. I mean, I always thought it was fun when my dad would hang out with his brother because like you get to see a side of like you know, you never even get to really see a hint of your father, at least mine anyway.
Yeah.
So I thought that was kind of because I think this scene is pretty heartwarming for what it is. Like the obvious delight the brothers have in hugging each other, the ridiculousness of what the fuck are you doing here? I came, you know, Tommy's like hanging a Christmas tree and shit. And Joel's like, I came here to save you. It's just and they laugh because it's so fucking hilarious. Like he's thinking that, you know, he's out here with raiders or worse and he's wrapping Christmas presents and stringing the tree. Like it's just patently absurd.
And there's this issue that's hanging in the air that, you know, when you see the conditions that Tommy's living in and they're great, fantastic. Mm-hmm. And you think, why did Joel get into this? Well, he got into this whole thing because he thought his brother was in danger. And the overriding emotion here is relief and joy, right? Seeing Tommy again. And Joel's not thinking about, boy, what a fucked up thing this is that I traveled across the entire country and here's my brother just living the life of luxury compared to me. It'll come back and we'll see him, you know, really start to feel that later in the episode. But right now it's there for us as an audience and we see it. But Joel's ignoring it because of how happy he is to be reunited.
I noticed there's a couple of things that I want to talk about. There's like when they're riding up to the gates, one of the riders is flying a red handkerchief, and they've clearly got some kind of signal system. So, like, you know, if they weren't flying any flag, maybe that's a sign that there's hostile, or if they got a red flag, they got strangers. So make sure there's armed security. I like that, but like, I thought sure that they would have Joel and Ellie on the back of their horses, but Joel and Ellie actually have horses, implying that they just bring spare horses in case they round up strangers. Or
yeah, I didn't rewind. Or did they
lose
two
people on this ride? You know,
like, maybe yeah.
And
they left them back there. We'll come get you.
And the two towers where the Rohirrim are like, oh yeah, we had these two guys die. I hope their horses carry you better than they did.
Or it's an Always Sunny. I'll come back for you, you know. I was looking to see, as the scene was playing out, if there were two other people on the backs of horses. But I don't know why them ride.
First of all, it's not easy to ride a horse at full gallop.
Sure.
I don't think so anyway. I think it's wild that you put a 14-year-old girl who's probably never seen a horse in her life on the back of this horse and just like hang on, you know, and she's like riding at you like with her back straight and her like it seems crazy that you would double up your own people so the newcomers can have their own horse when the newcomers might even not know how to fucking ride.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm with you. That was a little surprising to see Joel on his own horse.
Just have emergency spare horses, just pull it out of their side saddlebags and boom.
Yeah, I mean, if you can, you might as well. All right, Ellie and Joel eat. And then Ellie yells at someone who's staring at her. We find out that Jackson has been leaving bodies of, I don't know, bad people, I guess, around for others to find, to build a reputation as a place where you want to stay away from. Tommy also tells Joel that Maria is his wife now. And boy, she gets a dirty look from Joel. Joel's not into this.
Yeah, Joel played finding out about Tommy getting married the same way he played Henry holding a gun to him. Yeah, everything's going to be fine. I'm relaxed. It's
yeah, that's pretty much his demeanor for like the next 20 minutes of this episode.
Yeah. And their odd couple routine here where Joel's just being aggressively polite, you know, like he's using all of the proper mamming Maria for every chance he gets. And Ellie is like literally the bad girl your mom and dad warned you about. She's got a pack of cigarettes rolled up in her sleeve. She's got tattoos and eye patch and a facial scar, being like, oh, wait until I get a couple days with your goody two-shoe kids watching Richard Dreyfuss movies in their comfort with their popcorn. I'm going to teach them to fuck and swear and drink, you know?
Uh-huh.
It's just so funny, the contrast between them.
Yeah, it's great. We get to find out, or I really wanted to know at this point why Tommy didn't get back to Joel on the radio. It was like the primary thing in my mind, right? I see what's going on here and I'm like, why didn't he radio him? And we'll find out here in a bit. But Tommy is looking across the table at Ellie for half of this scene. Mm-hmm. And not because Ellie's the one speaking, but because I think he's trying to assess the relationship here. You know, he's thinking about Sarah too.
Yes.
And he sees this young girl with Joel and he's like, he's probably like, how has my brother changed in these last few years or whenever Tommy left? Because he's now showing up with someone that would be very strange for Joel to have in his company, given everything he's been through.
Yeah, it's like it's also got to be seen like going through a time machine. Like you haven't seen your brother in God knows how long, and he shows up, and it's like 20 years flash. You know, he's got a girl exactly the same age as Sarah was when she died.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly, it's not like Tommy's forgotten that. I mean, he's got a whole shrine to Sarah.
Yeah.
And we find out in the episode that was his idea. It wasn't like Maria's like, oh, I miss my kids. Oh, I kind of had a kid too. It was his idea from the jump. So. Yeah, I could see it staring.
Yeah, totally. All right, let's move over to Tommy and Maria giving Joel and Ellie a tour of the community. They have plenty of amenities, including power from the hydro station. It's a commune, and they're communists. Joel and Ellie get a house to stay in. It's the town tour. I really enjoyed this.
Yeah, they didn't answer a lot of questions when I watched it a second time because I was kind of raised my eyebrows. You know, I mentioned like, how do you take like, you know, you got a 6 people and then you go to 300 people and you get the dam going. Like, there's so many things that could go wrong. They mentioned that like this was a gated community already. So it's like, yeah. You know, a lot of the heavy lifting was done and they had instant protection from risk. So it's like they kind of found their own abandoned Alexandria from The Walking Dead and they had a jump start on all that. Someone had already put up the cold rolled steel walls and and they just had to kind of like, you know, I mean, again, I can't undersell the what an enormous undertaking it must have been to get the hydro dams working.
Sure.
And that's a detail that they have in the game. Like in the game, you never go to Jackson in The Last of Us Part One. You are on you find Tommy at the dam, and they're actually currently working. Like that's the project they're doing is trying to resurrect this thing. They've got a couple of college people, a college degree, and an engineer or two, and they've been this has been like their Manhattan project, and they're on the cusp of getting it turned over.
I was kind of expecting an action scene in this episode because of that portion of the game, but
and that's the thing, it's like every chapter in the game is going to have a big action scene, and they mentioned on the podcast that like they worry about audience fatigue, that like you can, you know, if the violence and action, because someone said this on the podcast, the instant talk, it's like you know, it's a great episode, but I still wish they could throw a clicker or an effect or something just to kind of keep that pulse going. And I think their instincts as showrunners is good that instead of doing that, they're like and worrying about the in fact, attacks no longer being shocking or frightening or whatever. It's like, you know, have a couple episodes where you don't see any danger so that when it does happen, it still has that fresh impact. You don't want people to come desensitized to it. Because, yeah, for sure, that happens in The Walking Dead. You're 11 seasons in, and, you know, you just, it's dumb when people die to single zombies or even like a small group. It's like, why would they? Where here, it's a lot scarier.
Yeah. I mean, the Walking Dead felt like it was primarily a zombie show. And so they felt they needed to get a zombie in every single week. And they'd fail if they didn't. This is not primarily a show about the infected.
Right.
There's a couple of good looks and lines here in this scene. As we're touring the town, Joel kind of asks, you know, how do you keep this place safe or secret or whatever? And Maria says something about, well, partially we stay off the radio. And Tommy gives this guilty look. Over, like, he kind of looks back sheepishly at Joel, and Joel kind of like, we're gonna talk about this.
Fucking Pinko commies staying off the radio.
Yeah, now it's starting to kick in, right? Like, oh yeah, I'm here because of a thing, and we need to resolve this because it is not what I expected. There's another part of this scene at the very end where I get the feeling that Joel feels kind of inferior to his brother, and maybe all of these crazy ideas Tommy has had about the ways to live his life, right? Going off and joining the military and then leaving the military and joining the Fireflies, leaving the Fireflies. I think Joel's kind of surprised and a little dismayed that Tommy has somehow landed in this very nice life that he has not been able to find, and maybe a little resentful because he feels like he's given him that opportunity and not had it for himself. Because at the end of this, like, Ellie, when they mention, oh yeah, we've got these houses over here that you can stay in, and Ellie's like, gotta be better than the shitholes we've been staying in, and Joel's like, we've been doing fine, like staring daggers at her. I get the feeling that he's like angry, almost angry at Tommy, or resentful of Tommy for finding this better life.
Yeah, I definitely think there's that. I think there's also an element of, you know, Joel is admitting to his weaknesses in this episode, and like, but maybe he thinks that he's done pretty good. Like, maybe Ellie doesn't understand that, like, he's, but like when Ellie's like, oh yeah, we've had a really rough go of it, that kind of like triggers his failures. One thing for him to beat himself up, but someone else to be like, oh yeah, you kind of fuck up from here, and we haven't been doing
she
well.
Hit a nerve.
That, yes, exactly.
Yeah, he realizes she's right. I don't know. Then we're going to go to another real good scene here where Joel and Tommy go to the town bar to catch up. Tommy asks about the kid. Joel says he was paid to take her to the Fireflies and asks where they are. Apparently, they have a base over at the University of Eastern Colorado, which is about a week's ride south. He asks Tommy to come with him, but Tommy turns him down, and it leads to a discussion about the things they had to do to survive, why Tommy didn't radio him back. Apparently, it's because he's going to be a father, and he doesn't want the wrong people to find the place, which, boy, that kind of sets Joel off. He gets offended. He says, oh, fine, I'm leaving in the morning. We'll be out of your hair.
But Joel's looking for a way to... He's looking for a thing to take offense because he is just dealing... Mm-hmm. Like, there's nothing... Tommy's not saying anything wrong that, like, I'm going mm-hmm. to be a father. I got to be more careful. Like, Joel, in normal circumstances, I'm sure would be happy for him. But he is, you know, the fact that Tommy's going to get a shot at the life that was taken from Joel. The fact yep. that Joel has gone through hell in 3 months, worried about his brother, and his brother is sat up here in the lap of fucking luxury. Like Joel is doing as good as he can not to like put hands on Tommy and probably throttle him, right?
Yeah.
But you know, I guess we'll find out. That was they missed on this podcast. Like that's the best that Joel can do. You know, like Joel mm-hmm. and in his present state of emotional constipation and closed offness, like just not being a complete asshole is a struggle for him, but he manages to do it. But Tommy interprets that as hurt and he, needles him back, you know, just because life stopped for you doesn't mean it has to stop. Now Joel's pissed and he can get the fuck out of there.
Yeah. Because, it's so apparent, even from early on in this scene, like that Joel is trying to appear stronger than he is. And it's down to when Tommy asks about Tess, like, how's Tess? And Joel's like, oh, she's good. She's fine. Well, Tess is dead. Like, we know that's not true. It just shows, yeah, I don't know if he's not willing to admit that his life has been, I guess, less than his brother's at this point because he's been stuck in this past, right? Or if he's just been unfortunate and he's ashamed of that somehow. But I don't know. Joel's complicated and I like it.
That's the thing. Like Joel and Tess met a long, long time ago. They could have had mm-hmm. the life that Tommy's got. I mean, it wouldn't have been quite this idyllic.
How do you find a Jackson? Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. Like, how do you find a Jackson?
But he could have found as a happiness. He had a more happy state right there in his own two arms when him and Tess were together, and he kept mm-hmm. them from becoming more than what they were.
True.
And that's kind of probably got a wrinkle on him too. That, like, you know,
yeah,
Tommy's able to surpass him. Tommy's able to do things that he can't do. He's able to move on in ways that Joel can't.
I think he's resentful of like the freedom that Tommy's had, right? As somebody who never had a kid and then didn't lose a kid specifically, more importantly, he's not had the challenges in his life, I guess, that Joel's faced.
And you know, there's always that little baby brother thing, like, oh, you don't even fucking know. But also the fact that, like, I think Joel thinks if their positions were flipped, at the very minimum, he would have gotten word out. Yeah, I'm not supposed to use the radio. Yeah, I'm not supposed to do that. Yeah, I'm not supposed to do that. But I would have found the way, goddammit. And the fact that you didn't mm-hmm. makes me almost think that you weren't even thinking of me. Because if you were thinking of me at all, you would have found the way.
Yeah.
Like, you, not only did you move on and you got this new life, but you have left me behind.
Yeah, he could have traveled a state away, right? He could have gone to the East Colorado University and sent a message out from there if he really wanted to.
Right. There's so many things. And like the bottom line is, from Tommy's point of view, he didn't think he'd ever see Joel again. Mm-hmm. And that Joel would always wonder, what the fuck happened to my brother? And Tommy didn't really care.
Wow. That's fucked up, right?
I think that's what the subtext of the scene is, that, mm-hmm. you know, you dropped off the map and I crossed a whole fucking country to make sure you're okay. And you did that to me without even thinking.
And it manifests as him being a real asshole, you know, when Tommy's like, mm-hmm. I feel like I'd be a good dad. And he's genuinely excited about this. And then Joel just shits on it, right? Well, I guess we'll find out.
And I don't think Tommy's thinking of all these implications either.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah. I think you're right. And he's kind of losing sight of the thing that is Joel's primary motivator, which is the loss of Sarah in this moment in favor of his own new child that he's about to have. And like, you know, that Joel thought he would have this life. Joel wanted this life for himself and he didn't get it. And now seeing Tommy starting to get it is stirring up a lot of emotions in him.
That's not fair.
Yeah, it certainly doesn't seem fair. Yeah, and I think I talked about this in the instant take a little bit, but like in Joel's worldview, all you have to live for is protecting your family, right? Mm-hmm. And now his family doesn't need any protection. Mm-hmm. His family's good. Yeah. They're set up. He thought he had this mission. He thought his brother was in trouble. Well, I got to go protect him. That's what I'm living for now. He doesn't have Tess. He doesn't have Sarah. He doesn't have Tommy. It's kind of it for him.
And this is also like goes back to that dichotomy of Tommy being a joiner and Joel being a keep to yourself type of guy. Like Tommy's the one that wants to pull over and help the family. Joel wants to mm-hmm. preserve the family. Tommy wants to join the army, go halfway around the world, spread democracy, save the world. Joel thinks that's stupid. Tommy has completely joined with his whole heart and mind and not look back. And Joel knows he would never do that in Tommy's place. So mm-hmm. Like I said, I think it's definitely stuff that you have to surmise. Like this isn't like, you know, they don't talk about their feelings in that direct a way, but I think it's all there and it's all stuff that's compiled from previous episodes. All those times where people are complaining about, we're not getting any, I mean, well, half the stuff we're talking about happened in the Bill episode that everyone said, no, you know, Joel and Ellie didn't get any character development.
Joel needs a Frank. That's what he needs.
Those seeds have matured and grown and ready to be harvested.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great. All right, we're outside the bar. Joel starts having another panic attack, but it doesn't last long because he's distracted by someone that reminds him of Sarah. Of course, it's not her.
I think he has a panic attack because he sees the Christmas tree, hears people singing Christmas mm-hmm. carols, and he realizes there's only 7 shopping days left until mm-hmm. Christmas, and he hasn't gotten anyone a gift. Suddenly, right. all the pre-apocalypse holiday stress comes flooding back, and what is he going to do? Is the Walmart even still open? Oh, my God.
He's hearing Tickle Me Elmo in his ear. He's seeing Furbies flashing eyes.
Where do I even get a Furby in the apocalypse? Oh, my God. You know what? Also, yeah. We talked about how much we would like to get a Christmas episode of this show. We got a fucking Christmas episode of this show.
You're right.
it's like straight out of Whoville. You got the whole community holding hands, singing songs around a Christmas tree. It's fully decorated.
Mm-hmm. You're making a joke about this, but I think it is partially the Christmas tree that triggers him, because if you see later in the episode, he's having flashbacks to a Christmas with Sarah.
Because how can you not? Like, you know, right. Like that Sarah died right at the like exiting the apex of Christmas as a parent. Like Christmas is so fun from the moment your kid is born up until they start just asking for cash and envelopes. then it becomes inventing new ways to keep it kind of family friendly and fun. We'll watch Die mm-hmm. Hard instead of Rudolph and all that kind of stuff. But like, like if you know, how could he not think about the Christmas times in this situation? That's a really good connection.
All right. Ellie showers and finds new clothes left out for her, as well as a Diva cup, which, we got to talk about this. She walks across the street and lets herself into Maria's empty house, where she finds a memorial to some dead kids. Maria returns and gives her a coat and a haircut. During the haircut, she lets it slip that one of those dead kids was actually Joel's daughter, Sarah. Maria shit talks Joel, and Ellie kind of defends him. And then Maria warns Ellie to be careful who she trusts and decides we're going to the movies. All right. What do you know about Diva Cups, Aaron?
I did
a little research.
Known a couple of gals that use them. I tell you what, if I was a vagina haver, I would be 100% team Diva Cup.
It seems cheaper for one.
It's cheaper. It's less like, you know, if you're comfortable with sticking your fingers inside yourself, and I'd like to think I'd be the type of person that would. Mm-hmm. Then it's like, it seems like it's the ultimate solution. It's just like piece of silicone or maybe latex. It's flexible. It's designed to go way up inside and like essentially hug the cervix, so that all the material that comes out during the menstruation cycle gets collected in that cup. And then periodically through the day, you reach up there, you dump it out into the toilet, you rinse it out, you put it back in, and then you're good to go until the next time.
I would be
you can sterilize. You can boil them, and sterilize them if you're super.
But yeah.
Well, I mean, I guess like the first time. Paranoid. Yeah, the first time or two you'd use it, but it's like maybe. But like, yeah, I don't know. I imagine women are laughing their asses off at that statement. But maybe you
sure,
do.
Maybe.
There's a chance of leakage if you don't apply it properly.
This is not the research I did. I was talking about researching the company, the Diva Cup company, because in our chat, I saw during our instant take, people were chatting and being like, yeah, there's no way that this was a thing in 2003. And I'm thinking about it. Hadn't heard about it in 2003.
Right.
Apparently, specifically, this brand, Diva Cup, was started in 2003. So this is like a first run minstrel cup here.
Because I know that these minstrel cups have been around since I think the late 70s or early 80s, but like it's like kind of like they're the Kleenex of
right
of feminine hygiene cups. Like they're just in fact I didn't I mentioned Diva cups on I did not know that this was an actual Diva cup. I you know didn't freeze frame and all that stuff. I
yeah it said it like on the instructions.
Yeah, so this is like, yeah, this is the Kleenex of menstrual cups, and
people who are worried about the shelf life of tampons should, I guess, rightfully be worried about the shelf life of the silicone. I don't know. They say 10 years.
Probably, is it 10 years? I imagine the apocalypse. But, you stretch that. It's like daily wear contacts. You know, like some people
totally.
It always freaks me out, but like, you know, people that wear the daily wears for like a month at a time, you know, so they can stretch them out, you know, but why would a silicone cup go bad? Like, unless it got brittle or it got a tear in it, like it's infinitely reusable.
Yeah. Yeah, totally.
And it's a pretty, like, it's not like it's a rough, it's not like you're dragging it through the desert and it's getting teared. I mean.
No, it degrades. I mean, silicone degrades over time, but yeah, not that quickly. So.
Yeah, I've been inside its active environment. It doesn't seem a particularly hostile place, you know. It doesn't seem like there's a lot of thorns and thistles and fire-breathing dragons, centipedes, that kind of stuff. Maybe you'd think so, but no, it's actually kind of nice. Watch out for that fungus. We'll be right back with more Savage Starlight. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R. R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun, fan-favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what two-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info. We found something to fight for. This podcast. Welcome back to Savage Starlight. Let me pivot over to this memorial setup. So we find out okay, Sarah, we know, was 14. This kid named Kevin was 3. Is this Tommy's kid or is this just Maria's kid?
I think Maria said something in the dialogue that that was hers. That she just had the one.
It makes a lot more sense because I did not think it had been 3 years since Tommy left, let alone the almost four it would take for the kid to be 3. So, okay, that makes sense. Then we go over to the town watching a movie in the theater. Ellie sees Tommy leave.
Oh, wait, can we talk about, we just talked about the Diva Cup for all the, I want to talk about the scene with Rutina Wesley and Ellie, Maria and Ellie. I thought that was really great because it's something that we don't see in the video game. In a video game, we stay with Joel's perspective. Ellie goes off Maria, and when she comes back, she's clearly pumped Maria for information because she's discovered about Joel's daughter and she's got all this more, but like seeing it from Ellie's perspective and that, you know, that hostility that Maria has towards Joel, not just because he's a murderer, but because Tommy's a joiner, and traditionally the person he's joined with most often is Joel. And she's got a good thing, and like she's really worried about Tommy running off on some damn fool idealistic crusade, which he does. Like these are all valid fears. And Craig and Neil talked about how in their mind they intended to film this as a fight. You know, like this is an action sequence and dialogue. This is two people sparring, trying to get the best of each other.
Okay.
One that's a lot better than at it than, you know. We also mentioned that the timeline about Maria, who was an assistant district attorney, and it was 20 years ago, and she's got to be. So Rutina Wesley in real life is 44. I did some research, and if you're a county assistant district attorney, you can be hired right out of law school. So it's conceivable that as a 24, 25-year-old, she could have just started her job as assistant district attorney. And because she mentioned some county, I forget what state it was.
Omaha,
was it
in Nebraska?
Omaha. So it's like, you know, probably not a metropolis. And 20 years have passed and she's just on the the waning years of possible childbirth without complications. It's pretty, it's, you know, it's risky post 40, but like, you know, she seems like she's in excellent health and et cetera. So it wasn't as ridiculous because I thought they're talking about a district attorney, like the district attorney. Yeah. And I'm like, there's no fucking way, but assistant. Yeah. In Omaha.
Sure. I'll buy it. You ready to go to the movie theater?
Yes, I am.
All right. The only thing that really happens here is we watch, I think we're watching the movie The Goodbye Girl, but I've never seen it to verify. So
do you know, apparently it's about a man and a woman entering a relationship and the woman's got a child from a previous one. And a lot of it's about the child accepting the Richard Dreyfuss character as her dad. And I guess the scene at the end of it, this is the first time they are meeting, and I guess she tells the mom that this guy would make a good dad. And obvious parallels between what's going on with Ellie and Joel here.
Yeah, especially when she pulls up her sleeve and says, "I'm immune." Yeah, that part.
Exactly. A little on the nose, but you know.
Yeah, a little bit. Ellie sees Tommy leave, which is important to later scenes. So then
that's pretty slick how they used Joel's voiceover of Ellie walking around the town trying to find him. They don't ever, because I was looking at the scene, I was like, are we going to see like Ellie with her nose pressed up against the window or something in the background? But like
her walking down the street is enough.
The way they edited it to where that's blended together, it's not a surprise when we find out later.
Right. So let's talk about that. Tommy brings Joel a new pair of boots and apologizes for their earlier conversation. Joel tells Tommy Ellie's immune to the infection and then gives him the details of their journey. And while he's recounting it, we see Ellie wandering down the street looking for Tommy. Joel says he's not capable of getting Ellie to her destination alive and begs Tommy to take her. Tommy agrees that they'll leave at dawn. He even promises not to tell Maria. And then he points Joel over toward his house and goes back to the movie. Whew, Joel falling apart. The first thing I notice in this scene is when he's like squeezing at his boots with these pliers, he's either got arthritis or just sore hands or something. I mean, that's he's falling apart, man. Panic attacks. He's got bad knees or a back or something, arthritis. I guess that's 56, huh?
Yeah. I mean, I just threw my back out this weekend at 46. I'm recovering from that. So like, I imagine another 10 years of mileage ain't going to be much better. But yep. This is another good scene. I mean, we've talked about a lot of it already. I will say that I was listening to an official podcast. I was really hoping that one of our instant talkers on Sunday night had the theory that Joel referring to these nightmares he has where he feels like he's always losing, he's always failing, is a nod to the video game reality in which, unless you are some master video game player that I am not, you will die many, many, many horrible deaths as Joel before you restart at the last spawn point or checkpoint and resume until you fail again. And the homage of that is like Joel psychically aware of the video game self, that, you know, all the times he could have died. I thought that was such a banger theory. And then they don't acknowledge that on the official podcast at all. It's just, you know, this was Pedro Pascal's idea. Like, I guess it wasn't improvised, but they talked it on the set about him, you know, like you have these dreams where it's like the opposite of like you have that dream where it's like your birthday and you got a new bike and it's so real that you think you got a new bike, even though you didn't. And you're kind of bummed to wake up. He's like, there's like other dreams you can have where you lose something and it feels so real, but you don't remember it. You just wake up with this just feeling of loss.
Yeah.
And that's something that Joel is waking up with every fucking day. That's a great interpretation, too. But I got to say, I like that he's dreaming his alternate Joel death dreams.
Sure. He could be doing both, right? And just waking up because him dying in those scenes is him failing.
True. Every time Joel dies, implied, Ellie dies shortly after.
Yeah. No, I really love this scene. There's so much, such a powerful scene. This is one of the very few insights we get into Joel. I mean, he doesn't open up with people like this. The fact that he's at the end of his rope and he's got his brother here allows him to be more vulnerable in this moment. And what really comes through in this entire scene is not how fearful Joel is and how angry he is at himself, but how much he cares about Ellie. Like, that's the driving force of all this. If he didn't give a shit about Ellie, he wouldn't be having this conversation. He would just be letting her go. He wouldn't continue this mission, or he'd go along knowing, I might die, but it doesn't really matter that much. He cares about Ellie, and it's not just that Ellie could be the salvation of humanity. I think he's bonded with this girl over the course of the last 4 months to the point where he cannot bear to think that she would die.
Yeah, and I expressed some confusion because I was always confused in the game about, like, why isn't the natural thing is just like, will Joel and Tommy escort Ellie? If not, get a posse of people to Tommy trust and stuff, because, like, this is the most, you know, potentially the most important person in the whole fucking world. After I watched this a bunch of times and I listened to the creators talk about it, like, when Joel says, I can't do this, he's like a 5-year-old, you told a 5-year-old to pick up an engine block and they go up and they try to, they can't do it. They just can't, they're not physically capable.
Yeah.
And something I've appreciated as I've gotten older in life is that we think of strength in terms of physical terms. And like, you know, obviously you wouldn't expect a 5-year-old to carry an engine block, even though a very strong man might be able to lift that up. Right. With emotional and mental strength and toughness, we just assume that's infinite if you care enough about it, right?
Right, right.
But I've come to appreciate that, like, people have limits on that stuff, just like real physical limitations. And Joel, when he's saying, I can't do this, he literally means it. I fucking can't do it. In my present mental state, where I'm having constant panic attacks about failing this girl, I can't do it. It's like asking the 5-year-old to move that engine block. It's not about how much he cares, not about how much he loves, not how much how he doesn't want to disappoint people. It's just like he has a finite capacity and it's been exceeded. And when I think about it in terms like that, clearly it would make more sense, you know, for them both to take that. Just like it might make sense for the 5-year-old to pick up the engine block and do something useful with it. But this is not going to happen.
Yeah, and from Tommy's perspective, if there's someone else to do this, he's not going to, right? I mean, you've got his brother here begging him to take on this responsibility because he can't anymore. Tommy has responsibilities of his own that I think are just as important to him. And the only reason he's ever going to agree to this is because it's so important to Joel and Joel is incapable of doing it. And so when Joel comes back the next day and says, I'm giving you the choice, and Ellie chooses him, Joel's had time, a little bit of time to process this, right? And this might just be what he needed to get him back on track. I'm sure, like, he's still on the edge, but maybe not as on the edge as he was before. And so Tommy's not going to go with him if Joel doesn't absolutely need him to.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to dovetail.
If Joel is capable of doing this, Tommy will let him do it because he has things that are extremely important to him as well. This family he's about to have.
And this conversation is the realization Joel's has going to dovetail into the next scene. But before we move on to that, I just want to mention that, like, the one thing I do find inexcusable to this day is when Joel says, you can't tell anyone, Tommy, I only trust you. Tommy should have absolutely told Maria and probably a couple of his really trusted friends on the council. And then he shows up next morning with like five serious people that they can be trusted to not. And like Joel's like, I only trust, like, fuck you, Joel. Like, you only trust me. Well, I don't have that problem. I trust a lot of people. And if this isn't important, as you said, then we're not going to take it a chance. We're not going to take a chance on my fucking sub MOA optimized rifle and just my own strong right hand and sharp right eye. Like, we're going to, I wish that they had done that.
Totally. Yeah. It doesn't make perfect sense here for Tommy not to tell Maria at least.
But it does fuck up the rest because, like, how could Ellie say no? Like, if Joel Joel comes next morning, is like, oh, I could take, and like, there's, it's not just Tommy or Joel, but it's like Joel plus Tommy and a bunch of other, like, then that's it completely transforms the game. So at some point, you got to kind of accept the logic of this, but it does, like, I don't think there's any rational, oh, they're just not emotionally strong enough to trust type of, you know, argument. It's just, no, this is,
yeah, and I don't know why Joel thinks that no one else could possibly believe that she's immune. Like, they're just going to shoot her. They're going to see an old scarred up thing on her arm and just blow her head off before they even think about it. No.
Some people would, but I think Tommy would know the people to trust. And I don't think Maria would do that.
Right.
And also, I'm not saying this is unrealistic because I know there are dudes out there with their codes of honor that would do this exact same shit. If your brother came up and said, you can't tell anybody, even if you think it's fucking stupid, you're still going to, because that's what you told your brother's going to do.
And honestly, Tommy and Joel seem annoying. Like they could be that way, but you're right. You're right. I'm
100%
with you.
Oh, no, these guys are peas in a pod, I think, you know,
and they certainly were. I feel like they're diverging a little bit here because of the damage to Joel, because of the experiences each of them have had in isolation. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, but living on a commune, post-apocalyptic commune where everybody's getting together and raising kids has got to positively impact your feelings about humanity, right?
Oh, yeah.
You know?
And I like the moment where, you know, Tommy goes back to the movie theater and he chooses not to stand with Maria there because he can't talk. He can't talk right now. He knows that if he starts talking to her, he's going to tell her about Ellie.
And Marie knows. Maria knows.
Oh, she knows something's up. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think she has a pretty good idea of what it is.
Mm-hmm. And man, I just want to say how good this scene is from an acting standpoint, too. I mean, Pedro Pascal has never done better work. I don't know. I really loved him in this particular scene.
Yeah, no, you're right. He nailed it. Like, this is
just
like the
twinkling of tears in his eyes as he's explaining this to Tommy and the way the light just catches it perfectly.
And the thing is, I just watched a couple nights ago. I'm watching Better Call Saul, and I don't want to talk about that now. But there's a scene where, in like the middle parts of season 5, where they give Jimmy this speech where he just goes off and just unloads on somebody, and it just goes on, and like, you know, God, who's the guy that plays Saul? Jesus.
Bob Odenkirk
is just sinking his teeth in this. He just gets to rage as pure id, not as pure raw emotion. But it's not nearly as impactful as Pedro Pascal with red rimmed, you know, tear streaked face, because like this is a man who is so closed off and so like just you can, just through this little crack in the dam, you can see how much emotion is behind that. And I think that's actually kind of harder to play than someone having like a fucking Royal Shakespeare moment where they're just venting their spleen. Like the amount of control that you have to be this particular dialed in of a performance, I think is super impressive.
Yeah. No, I loved it.
Favorite I wouldn't. I mean, if Joel's just bawling and sobbing and snot running, it wouldn't play. It would seem false. But this is Joel
it
losing
play
his
as
shit.
Well, yeah.
This is Joel at the end. This is what this looks like, you know?
Yeah, this is this very strong man, the emotionally closed off man, having that moment where the dam is breaking, but like the dam is still there. It's just got a hole in it. Yeah.
Yeah.
So Joel goes back to the house where he finds Ellie. And realizes she's overheard his conversation with Tommy. She's angry and hurt and brings up Sarah, which is a big mistake. And Joel ends up telling her that he's leaving in the morning, leaving her, not going. Joel goes back to his room and remembers Christmas with Sarah. Boy, this is a hard scene to watch, man. A lot of it is straight out of the game. This line about just being more scared is definitely straight out of the game. Joel...
You're not my daughter. I'm sure as hell not your dad. That's another. Because I remember playing this and just thinking, and probably saying out loud even, like, Jesus, Joel. Like, this feels wrong when it's happening to you, you know?
And acting like you're the only one in the world who can feel loss because you lost something precious to you. There are a million yous out there, Joel. Everyone's lost someone. Look at the world. It's not your right to be the only person to feel like this. It's just that you're so stuck in it that other people, you see other people getting past it, moving on, and you get angry at them. The gatekeeping of loss and grief that goes on here is really, it's just a bad look for Joel and just the way he turns on Ellie here because he's unable to talk to her. He's unable to explain what's going on in his own head. It's rough.
Yeah, and he's... I think this is a mistake a lot of parents make with teenagers is to dismiss their emotions as like, you know, when they fall in love, it's like, oh, it's just stupid puppy love. It's this, that, and the other. And there's some truth to this. Like, you know, 20 years from now, will your 14-year-old look at their boyfriend and think, oh, my God, this was the love of my life? Probably not. In context, it'll be like, oh, but like in the moment when you're this is the greatest love that they've ever felt. And when it terminates, it will be the worst their heart has ever been hurt. And you have to kind of honor that. You can't, you know, maybe it'll be a time later to be like, oh, you know, things will get better and blah, blah, blah. You can't in the moment be like, you don't even know what love is. You know, that's like what a lot of people say, you know. And it's just Joel's trying to do that. There's also a little bit, they mentioned this on the official podcast, of when he's like, stop, not another word. There's a little bit of pleading like he did with the old man. Like, don't. You're just like Joel knew he would shoot that guy if he had to. Like, I think Joel knows he'll be cruel to Ellie if she comes and attacks him at this vulnerable point.
Yeah.
And he's like, please don't make me do this. Don't, you know, don't lash out at me. So I'll have to lash out at you. And it's
sad to cap this scene off with him remembering Sarah at Christmas, because this is a life he could have. I mean, we've seen Tommy in this horrible world grow into a life like that. Right now, if he were able to move on and acknowledge that, yes, this is a terrible thing, and he's still sad that he lost Sarah, he could put up a memorial plaque for her, right? But like, you could be having this right now. Right now, you just can't get past it.
Well, that's the greatest. I think that's one of the best lines in the episode where Tom, you know, they're talking about the way they used to live and how they used to get by and murder and raiding and all that kind of stuff. And Tommy says, you know, there are better ways to live, Joel. We just weren't any good at it. And why weren't they good at it? What did they, you know, they obviously have an abundance of this type of physical strength. Did they not have the emotional strength? Did they could not? I don't know. There's a lot to unpack there, but I thought that's just such a great line that, you know, we are fooling ourselves by saying we did the things we had to because look at me now and I don't have to. Yeah. But
yeah.
Also, they kill people. They do kill the wrong people that come into this community. They don't let them go in and vote, you know, to fuck up the. So like you still murder people, Tommy, but maybe not just to put food in your belly.
Yeah, yeah.
That's such a funny thing where they say, you know, that they make examples out of the wrong sort of people. But then later in the episode, Maria is giving a tour to town. She talks about how the old bank is a jail, but it's empty. There's nothing. We don't have anybody in it.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you lock up the dangerous people you're not sure about for instead of just killing them. Maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, I can't tell because Tommy calls it like he describes these people as the people who've tried them. And to me, that means like they've come in, they've attacked them, specifically tried to like harm them, not just shown up and not fit into the community, right? So maybe it's something where, well, if they're trying to kill us, we have to kill them to stop them. But
look, I would love to go into the civics and politics of this place, but if we do, right, it's going to be another 2 hour, over 2 hour long podcast.
Well, then let's move on.
Because I do also wonder, like, what if someone decides they have a breach in this community where there's just loggerheads and like one family just wants to move. Okay, fuck it, you do whatever you. We're gonna. Did they let them leave?
Right, because they don't let them use the radio.
Right. So I would love to see like what kind. Yeah, how would this society deal with like it's essentially a civil war. People want to leave the union. You can't. It's against the law. You can't do that.
Yeah, we'll
throw you in jail.
We'll see anyway, if we come back again to this, but I don't know. Yeah. Tommy's still there, so we could.
Yeah, and I'm not saying that's even a bad thing to do in this particular world. It's just, yeah, I'd love to see that shit get explored.
Tough decisions. All right, the next day, Tommy takes Ellie to the stables to get some horses. They find Joel there. He's apparently decided to give Ellie the choice to go with him or Tommy. Ellie immediately chooses Joel. Tommy says, you guys have a place here in Jackson when you get back. And Joel borrows Tommy's gun and they say goodbye.
When Tommy came to knock on Ellie's door, did that make him a Tommy knocker?
Oh, my God. Here's shame on you. Secondly, Tommy gave Joel his gun. Does that make it a Tommy gun?
Oh, I did 100%. He's a Tommy knocker wielding a Tommy gun.
Yeah. Yeah. There's your quota for puns this week.
Mm-hmm. Now, when we go to the ad, make every shot count. We'll be back with more of Savage Starlight. You've been listening to quite a few Bald Move podcasts now, but you're not in the club? Whoo boy, you are missing out.
Not only are all of our premium club podcast feeds completely ad-free, but we have lots of other great content exclusively for people in the club.
There's a weekly lunch with Jim and Aaron where we chat with fans about anything and everything from TV and films, food, fun, life advice, and more.
But there's also Off the Clock, our premium podcast where we talk about all the shows we don't have time for on our public feeds.
Plus, you get access to our full spoiler-filled first-run movie reviews of our newly released films.
Don't forget Instant Take and Talk Podcast, where we give our hot takes and discuss television shows with our fans live and immediately after the episode airs.
With mega shows like House of the Dragon coming this summer, we're going to have lots to talk about.
Not to mention access to our fun and friendly community of club members, with exclusive Discord channels and a dedicated forum. It's one of the best places on the internet to hang out and chat about pop culture.
Bottom line, you're helping two regular type guys in the Midwest make the content you like to listen to, which some would say is rewarding to itself.
Help keep the lights on and the bits flowing at Bald Move.
And get some awesome content for yourself. Head to support.baldmove.com to join the club today.
We try to make it super easy to support making podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club.
But some people aren't the joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for a podcast that really spoke to them, or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love.
Ah.
We're not the cure for mankind, but we have your favorite podcast. Here's more of Savage Starlight. Anyway, I love this scene. Joel, the way Joel describes his journey, his emotional journey in this scene, like he came here to steal a horse. He's been standing around for 30 minutes, probably like saddling it up, probably wondering if he's making a mistake. 30 minutes later, here he still is. So you got a choice.
And this, yeah, like he could have gotten out of there before 30 minutes, but he's been stalling for time. And also there's a subtle grammatical shift where Joel came out to steal a horse, but then he asks Tommy, Tommy tells him there's a place for you here. And he says, I'm counting on it. And then Joel says, can I borrow your gun?
Like I'm
stealing implies you're never coming back. Borrowing is a promise I'm going to be back. And that shift happens after Tommy says there's a place for you here. I thought that was a really nice touch. And also, we haven't been, because like this is something I gushed about on the Insta Take, but like, my God, the scenery in this episode, this whole thing takes place like this, the stable against this dramatic mountain backdrop where there's like snow kind of obscuring it. Like God damn, this is a beautiful part of Canada that they're filming in. The Canadian, with the Canadian Rockies just always in the background. Oh my God.
Incredible. The other thing about this gun is this is, I think Tommy describes this as the gun that he probably had in the first episode, right? I mean, this is the gun that they were, he was wielding when they were fleeing, the gun he used to kill the soldier who shot Sarah. Yeah, so I like the full circle moment there. All right, let's go over to Joel and Ellie. They leave. He tries to teach her how to shoot, but she has a lot to learn. They continue writing as Ellie asks questions about ownership in the old world, contractors, football. And then within 5 days, they arrive at the University of East Colorado.
It's a lot of great moments here. You know, like Joel putting around right on the target. It's like one of those things where it feels good to be a superhero to your kids. You know, like every once in a while when you can do, you know, when your kid's struggling with something and you can nail it, or, you know, they mentioned this in a podcast. It's like it feels good to be the dad, but also as a kid, when you see your mom or dad do something super heroic, it reinforces that you're safe with them, like you're with a competent, serious. So it's like everyone loves it. I thought that was funny. The look on Pedro Pascal's face when he's like, yeah, we were pretty cool. Everybody loved contractors. And the way she kind of melted into his back at the end of that scene, like she just kind of like, you know, leans up against him, and it kind of brings tears to my eyes because it's just such a great way to show the fundamental shift that's happened in their relationship post Jackson.
Yes, absolutely.
And like it's she, like I love Ellie when she calls him on his badass, you know, dialogue where he's like, oh, what is Tommy didn't know what he's talking about. We had 5 easy days, no problems. There's still time to find out. Oh, the contractor. It's really funny.
Yeah, he's almost given himself a superhero name. Like you're saying.
He's John Wick.
Yep. He's revising history and building walls. So then they search the campus for fireflies while chatting about more stuff, about school, Joel's real wish for his future, which is to be a singer. They see monkeys. They spot a firefly symbol pointing them to the biomedical sciences building. So that's where they head. Do you want to talk about anything here?
No notes.
All right, let's get to the final scene. They get in the biomedical building. They find it abandoned. And then they hear a sound. They go up to investigate. It's just monkeys. They see a map that seems to indicate the fireflies might have gone to Salt Lake City. And then outside, they hear people talking, and they spot 4 guys with bats prowling around. They go out the back to get to their horse. Joel gets attacked and injured, but they manage to get on the horse and ride off. And once they get clear, Joel passes out and falls off his horse. And the episode ends with Ellie pleading for him to wake up.
Yeah, you know, there's not much to talk about here either. I like, you know, they're inferring all this stuff. They find the packing list, like people are getting packed up. Upstairs, they find a series of push pins and a map that converges to one central spot that implies a destination. So that's where we're going to be heading. And just like in a video game, just when you think, you know, they baited the jump scare with the monkey that turned out to be not a clicker, but just a monkey. And then they go down, and just when you think everything is in the clear and about to get off, this guy comes running with the club. And just when you think it's safe there, turns out mm-hmm. he broke that baseball bat. And I'm like, when did he get stabbed?
Me too. Yep.
But like, it's beautiful because that guy had the remains of the broken handle in his hands when Joel goes to tackle him, and his mm-hmm. hands, as Joel tackles him, are right in a position to jab that broken handle right where it was at.
Yeah, and it's and like, Joel doesn't even notice it, right? Joel's like, he's so jacked with adrenaline, he's so in fight mode, he kills the guy and then realizes it.
Yeah, and then he pulls it out, which, like I said, an instant take is the worst thing. Like, if your body ever gets punctured or something, leave it there until you get to the professionals. Because, yep. I don't know, I saw this one, the video where, like, an ER doctor took, like, a Ziploc bag full of, like, red liquid, and he stabbed a kitchen knife into it, and, like, absolutely nothing came out. As soon as you take it out, like, stuff starts pouring, you put the knife back in, it stops. Like, Not the crib from Star Trek, The Next Generation, but we are carbon bags, mostly full of water. science works. If you got something stuck in there, don't pull it out because it might be keeping you from gushing blood.
Yeah.
Joel, there is no one to help. So
right.
He pulls it out.
Gonna ride 5 days with a bat in your guts.
Yeah, and it's bad. Like, he immediately starts bleeding. They barely get out of there on horseback, and then there's that great shot of him, you know, on the train tracks. Finally, you know, again losing his physical strength and just falling off. And three times previous to this episode, Elia said, "If you die, I'm pretty much boned." And mm-hmm. now you see that not just the terror, but she's so scared, but also the sense of loss. Like, it's not just losing your protector, but you're losing a person you deeply care about at this point.
Yeah. No, it's super sad. I also think about it from Joel's perspective, you know, as he's fading out here. What's going through his head? I failed again. Right. I failed for the final time. Yeah. He's having fucking nightmares as he lays here dying. It's fuck, man.
Yeah.
It's terrible.
And that's the thing. It's like, here's again, it's like everyone understands losing. Like, no, you know, Joel can't open his eyes at the end and he's passing out and blood loss. No one would pass him and be like, what a fucking pussy. If he wanted to get up, he could. He would.
Right.
If he just wanted to, he just fucking get
man
up,
dude. But, come on.
But yeah, you have a series of panic attacks, like, fucking pussy. You just need to push through, man.
Right.
Also, great video uh-huh. game nod. Joel breaks a motherfucker's neck.
He does.
Do you know how many necks I've broken The Last of Us? It's my preferred method. You sneak up, you grab them, they struggle, snap. You don't use any bullets. You don't use any shivs. They just go, the light switch turns off. It's mm-hmm. great. It's a beautiful thing.
Got the time. Why not? All right. That's the end of the episode. I really want to talk some spoiler stuff.
Okay.
If you've got the time.
So I recognize this as the cover Depeche Mode's Never Let Me Down Again at the end of the song.
Oh, okay.
But like, I was like, wow, this is an interesting cover. I've never heard it before. I grabbed my trusty Shazam. It listened to it like two or three times and it failed. I'm like, what the fuck? That like, I can think of one time that Shazam has ever failed me. It's been some weird fucking cultural folk festival I went to. This is Neil Druckmann's 18-year-old daughter covering Depeche Mode, Never Let Me Down Again. And the lyrics, like, this is a song about abusing drugs. But the lyrics of it, I'm going on a ride with my best friend. I hope he doesn't let me down again. It ties so well to the theme, and having, you know, again, Neil Druckmann's daughter singing it, I thought was super poignant.
Isn't this the same song that episode one ended with?
Did it?
I want to say that's true.
They
I
did
can't
actually,
remember
did,
exactly.
they, but they did the Depeche Mode version, right?
Right. It was not this cover version, but same song.
Is that the way? Is that what they played for the Danger music? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Good catch. Apparently, that's true.
Yeah, I can't remember like the emotional. It was. I can't remember the emotional beat that the first one is ending on. It's more.
It's a
more
danger,
like implied
it's,
danger, yeah, but not like, the, like immediate
yeah,
danger.
It was
like
it's
is.
An 80s pop song that means danger, not that it has. Uh-huh. But now, wow,
the danger
that's
is made
a
very
that's a
real.
Fucking that's a fucking great choice and a great way to cover it because it just adds so much more layers to it.
Especially from it now being from the perspective almost with an 18-year-old girl covering this, almost mm-hmm. from the perspective of like Ellie, right? It's
100%.
Yeah. Whew. It's good stuff.
All right. I just about said it. That's it. But there's I forgot we have a spore lore section. Is this a spore lore or a super spore lore? It's just probably spore lore.
I think it's just spore lore.
So if you have played The Last of Us or you don't mind spoilers from The Last of Us, you can you're free to come along to this section with us. Otherwise, this will probably be the end of the episode for you. If you'd like to send us feedback, we'll be doing a feedback episode on Thursday. TLOU at baldmove.com is how you send that in. Follow along with everything that we're releasing on Twitter, twitter.com/baldmove if you want to stay abreast with the latest Bald Move stuff. And if you want to get rid of the ads, the annoying ads that play during our episodes, and watch get exclusive bonus audio content like our instant talk episodes that we record live right after the episode airs each Sunday night, go to support.baldmove.com. We could really use your support and we really appreciate it. Okay, there's gonna be a little bit more in the spore lore edition, but I do recommend everyone that has not played the first game get the hell out, get the hell out while you still can.
Mm-hmm.
All right,
yeah, we're all about right, to talk about zoo animals.
I think we've lost our tail, Jim. I think we're good to go. We could talk now.
All right, cool. They got the monkeys in there. They didn't get the giraffes.
Wait a second. Mm-hmm. The giraffes are in this scene? Because I thought that happened
no.
in Denver.
No, I...
Because these... I thought that the research monkeys were from the research. The others are from the zoo, right?
I could have sworn it happened here. You might be right. Okay.
Because, man, if they don't fucking do the giraffes...
I know. That's why I was so mad.
It's not like I'm going to riot because it's not like that makes or breaks obviously. A fucking game. But it would be like if they do... It would be like if they tried to adapt the second one without paying homage to some of Ellie's interests.
Okay. Yes, I know what you mean. Without
yeah.
saying anything.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Maybe it's not this part of the thing. So there are two like big plot points coming up that they're gonna have to stretch a little bit, I think, stretch the plot out for three more episodes. I'm looking at this, I'm going, well, the next episode is obvious what that's gonna be.
Yeah.
Although I saw like previous next time on stuff and it looks like we're gonna explore a little bit of Ellie's past, which I'm excited for. But yeah, the next plot point, which is just Ellie trying to protect Joel here, that stuff and then the stuff at like the very end of the game with the fireflies are like the two plot points we have left, but we got three episodes left.
Let me ask you this. When Ellie gets up at dawn, doesn't she run away in the video game?
She does. Yeah. I'm glad they skipped that here.
Well, yes, I think it's fine the way they did it, but like, doesn't Ellie get injured in the process? Because I remember thinking
I don't think so.
The point, because there's a point where Joel finds Ellie injured and is like, oh, Ellie girl, and fusses over her. And that's the point in the game you realize that he has, you know, he loves her like Sarah.
Did he find her injured? Because I remember a mad dash to find her. Like him and Tommy jump on horses
okay.
and ride as fast as they can. To go
like,
find her.
Because Joel's in a blind panic about her getting herself hurt. So, but I thought I remembered there was a scene at the end where he's like cradling her in her arms and like fussing over her. And you realize like, oh my God, it's happened. You know, he's.
Oh yeah. There's a whole sequence where you play as Ellie, right? And like these people are hunting you.
Well, that's in the next. I think that's going to be in the next chapter.
Well, there are two parts to that, I think, because I think Joel gets injured there.
Because right in the game, he falls and gets stabbed, like he like it's the old rebar through the guts in the game, right?
Well, I can't remember exactly. I'm sure this is thrilling for people who've played the game and know it extremely well.
Yeah.
But no, I think Ellie has the hunter, not hunters, but you know what I mean? People that are stalking her in this cabin. Uh-huh. She's holed up there and Joel comes in and saves her from that and gets injured in the process. And then we have the stuff that we're about to get into, I think. Mm.
Maybe. I did think, did you think that when we saw the guy stomping up in the cabin with the bow, that was Joel when the episode first started? I'm like, did they hole up in a cabin in the winter? I was trying to think of like how all that stuff happened. But, you know, it turned out to be Graham Greene, of course. But I was, because it's been about 18 months since I played the game last.
It's only been about a month.
I don't know what your excuse is, but I
don't have one. Bad brain? I don't know.
Bad brains.
No memory.
You got donkey brains.
I got the donkey brains. Here's one thing I do vividly remember is how hard it was to imagine that Joel would survive his injury in the game as well. It seems really hard to imagine he's going to survive here in the show.
Man, I tell you, but she finds antibiotics in the game, right? Or she trades, she barters for it.
I think so, but the rate at which he's bleeding out, just like the rate at which he passed out here, there's no help around. It really feels like, yeah.
Well, before we invented antibiotics, like any kind of wound to the torso, like penetrating wound to the gut or thorax was almost universally fatal just from the infection of it. But like if you can stop the bleeding and you can get penicillin into this guy, then most people will live, you know?
Yeah. No, now I'm remembering. Yeah, you're right. She tries to trade with these guys for medicine.
They get in trouble.
And Joel at some point will wake up, but like later
Yeah. So I'm very excited. I think the parts where you solo as Ellie are some of the best parts of the game, some of the most impactful, some of the scariest shit. And yeah, I'm
that
really
diner
excited.
Restaurant fight scene is real good.
I'm really excited to see how they handle that. That whole whiteout, you know, like remember that Fargo season one where they did and we talked about how that's so much like The Last of Us, but you got this phenomenon where like it's like real life cloaking device. You can't see a person 10, 15 feet in front of you and vice versa. It's so, so fucking atmospheric.
We need a brief super spoiler too.
Oh,
there's one thing we have to talk about because they're laying groundwork for it.
DEFCON 5, we have a super spoiler has been declared. You have 5 seconds to flee the area. 4, 3, 2, 1. The blast doors have closed. All right. We're contained within the super spoiler section. Jim.
I assume the girl
Sally fucking ride.
No, I assume the girl that's staring at Ellie during the scene where they're eating is Dina, right?
I didn't even think about that, making that early a connection.
I mean, why else put that in there? There has to be.
I was it was the contrast between how polite Joel is being because he's got social graces and Ellie. But I think you're probably right. You're probably right.
Yeah, that's my assumption. Just this laying that track. So that when Ellie does come back, you know, she'll have someone. It won't be like totally out of the blue and she won't have to like totally start fresh here. But
yeah,
they don't do much with it. I was surprised there wasn't a little bit more, honestly, if they were going to do anything at all.
Well, now that we're here in a super spoiler, I am going to talk about Sally fucking Ride.
That sequence is good.
Everybody talks about the giraffe sequence, which is fair enough. But I think the sequence in the museum is giraffe times 10 for me
when she gets into the capsule. Yeah, that's
and Joel
has
like Joel has done this as a birthday present for her, knowing how much she likes space, and has prepared this thing where she can listen to the Apollo 13 liftoff while she sits in the capsule, while she's wearing an authentic helmet because they just smashed a case that has all this stuff. And the game just lets you look at Ellie's face for like a minute, close zoomed up, as she's having this intense experience, and it's my hands down my favorite moment in a video game ever.
It's great.
So if,
yeah
If they don't do the giraffes, they'll start to be afraid that they're not going to do the Ellie Spaceman routine. And if they do that, then it's all for naught. It's all for fucking naught if you can't get that.
Why did we make the show?
Yeah. Yeah. And why are we talking about Sally fucking Ride if you're not going to build my hopes up to? Why would you show the giraffe plush, assholes, if you're not going to do the giraffe scene? All right? There's some stakes. There's some stakes, Neil, Craig. You got to deliver. True.
Anyway, that's all I've got. Just couldn't not mention that stuff.
Well, said it once, say it again. TLOU@baldmove.com. TLOU. If you want to make commercials go away and help us keep making podcasts, support.baldmove.com. If you want to know what we're doing on a week-to-week, day-to-day basis, other stuff you might be interested in, because there's a ton of stuff. It's a ton of stuff. Doing Mandalorian starting next week. A couple weeks away from Yellow Jackets. We're in the middle of Picard. Fully engaged with Picard season 3. If you're into that space shit, if you like Sally fucking Ride, check that out. twitter.com/baldmove. We will see you Tuesday for the feedback episode. Until then, I'm Aaron
and I'm Jim.
See ya.